Shall I start?
Yeah.
My name is Thomas Long, and I'll start with my father. My father and two brothers came to Dawson and the Gold Rush in 1898, and they stayed two winters prospecting. Then my father and one brother returned to the States. One brother, John Long, stayed in Alaska. He was later the first commissioner or second commissioner in Fairbanks. My father, in returning to the States, he married in Salt Lake City, Utah, my mother, and they went to the Philippine Islands, where my brother was born. In the Philippine Islands, they went to the Isthmus of Panama, where I was born, in Ancon during the canal construction. Then my father returned to Alaska in 1911, going to Ruby. And Ruby was struck in 1911. By that I mean that gold was first found in Ruby in 1911. Not in Ruby, but at Longford, 28 miles out and back of Ruby. And my mother and brother and myself came in 4 years later. And we landed in Dawson in the spring of 1915. And I remember we were 1 month early for the breakup, so my mother had to rent a cabin and set up housekeeping and cooking and wait for the river to break and to go down the river by boat to Ruby. At that time, there were a good many boats on the Yukon River. There was, I could name quite a few of them. There was the Hannah and the Julia B and the Seattle Number 1 and 2 and 3 and the General Jacob and the Jeff Davis. The Aleph, no, not the Aleph at that time, and the Sarah and the Susie, they're all big boats. So the Yukon River was a pretty busy stream. And at the time that we landed in Ruby, I wasn't too old at that time. Well, I remember the town as a pretty bustling town. It was a town of horses, because we used horses in those days, and they were expensive teams, match teams, the best that money could buy that they brought in those days, because all the wood and supplies for the miners on the creek were hauled by horses. And Long Creek, not named after my father, that's 28 miles out in back of Ruby, was where the first mining started, and the tributaries to Long Creek. And there was another creek out between Long Creek and Poor Man, Greenstone, which was one time the Googs had a dredge on. And then on out to Poor Man, where there was more mining. And you could look up and down any of those creeks, and you could see boiler house after boiler house and gin pole after gin pole all up and down the creek, and each outfit working quite a few men. Ruby at one time boasted at least four saloons, four grocery stores, a drug store, a newspaper, and a theater, and two hotels. Now it doesn't boast anything. The town is dead. There's nothing left of the town anymore because mining is practically nil. But I went to school in Ruby to grammar school, and then later on to high school here in Fairbanks. But the only mode of transportation in those days was in the summertime was by boat or by foot, and in the wintertime either by dog team or by foot. We kept 17 dogs the year round. My father did. My father used to make trips all the way to the Iditarod over into the Kuskokwim in the wintertime and bring prisoners from Flat and the Iditarod all the way up near the Fairbanks to go out to McNeil's Island. I might also mention that Ruby at one time had two lawyers in the town. One of the lawyers was E. Coke Hill. At one time, judge of the 4th Division here. He practiced law in Ruby, and he drove dogs in the races in Ruby. They had races in Nome, they had races in Ruby, and they had races in the Iditarod, were the three central places of dog racing in those days. Sheppler raced in Ruby. I could name quite a few of them. And the race was run from Ruby to Long Creek and return. That'd be a distance of 56 miles in one day. Uphill and downhill. It'd be like going from here to Chattanooga and back over the same kind of a course. In the winter time, your mare was brought into Ruby by dog teams. Teams of 21, 17, 21, 23 dogs. The mare would come in twice a week, regular on schedule, irregardless of the weather, more regular than the airplane. Bought it afterwards. I've seen as many as three men snowshoeing ahead of the mail team coming in down the river. And the load limit for the mail on the river was 800 pounds, and the load limit cross country was 600 pounds. In other words, I mean by this that the postmaster could force the mail carrier to take 800 pounds of mail, if he had it in the post office, in his sled, which wasn't too often, because they'd also haul freight. Besides, they'd have two big sleds, and the man would ride on skis. One section of the tow line is taken out, where two dogs are next to the sled. They have a G-pole that runs from the stanchion to the sled, alongside of the bow of the sled, and stands out. And the man stands on skis. And the big mail sled, you couldn't guide from the rear. They had to be guided from the G-pole. He stood on the skis, and he'd lean and pull on the G-pole and hold the trail to the sled. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to keep a long sled, or maybe two sleds on the trail. Or they might ride what was known as a Ouija board. A Ouija board, they'd ride cross-country. Sometimes preferably the skis, because skis are a little dangerous cross-country while they weren't on the river. A Ouija board was attached to the tow line. It was like a small toboggan. It was hitched into the main line. That is, your main line is that your dogs are attached to, and also attached to the sled. And then the man rode on the Ouija board. He could get off and walk because his feet were free. Well, in skis, his feet aren't free. I might say that Ruby wasn't as large a gold center as Dawson or Fairbanks either, but it was a pretty big gold center at that time. A lot of gold came out of the Ruby district. It was also a fur center, pretty good sized fur center, something similar to Fort Yukon, although not quite as much fur came into Ruby as Fort Yukon. So Ruby had quite a bit of wealth at one time. The entertainment. Well, they had lodges. They had the Moose Lodge at one time in Ruby, and they had the Pioneer Lodge. They still have the Pioneer Hall there yet, although there's only five members left in the town. The original pioneers belong to, I think it's Igloo number five. I'm his son, Tom Long. I'm Tom Long, Jr. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's about, I might say that I went to high school here, and after I was through school here, that I've worked all over a good part of the interior of Alaska. Worked over in the Kuskokwim and down the lower river and all over in this area here. And let's see, it was the spring of 1928. I went down to Ruby the fall of 1927 and stayed with my folks until February. Noel Ween at that time was flying to Nome. He had a Hamilton plane at that time. It was an all-metal plane, first all-metal plane in Alaska. And I believe the fare at that time was $150 from Ruby to Fairbanks, and from Fairbanks to Nome was $350. At one time, I think it was as high as $750 to Nome. Well, this particular winter, I wanted to come up and try to get in the last half of that school year. So the only way I could come was either walk or come with no wing. So I told him I wanted to come up with him. Well, he'd fly down to Nome and he'd have a full load of $350 passages. So every time coming back, he'd have to refuel at Ruby. They couldn't fly straight through without refueling. So he'd tell me, well, the next trip for sure. Well, it went on and on and on like that. The $350 passage was better than the $150 one. Finally he said, well, I'll save you a seat. For sure. Well, we landed. Shut the block full. No seat. I went home and I told my mother and father, I said, I'm starting out tomorrow morning up the river. And I walked up to Nenana in 8 days and it cost me $12. Because I knew most of the people in the roadhouse and they didn't charge me. Well, that's about all I could say, huh?
You know,
some of the people on the river,
the
children's safety, the riverboat, the boat. Well, it was, wood was burnt by all the boats at that time. Some of them were double stackers, they had two boilers. Some of them were single stackers, they had one boiler. I don't know how much they got a cord, I can't remember, for the wood. But they had wood camps all along the river, one side of the river or the other side of the river. Now this I don't know to be true, I mean, it probably is true, but I don't know. Well, Baker, do you remember a boat by the name of the Isom? Yeah. Well, the way it's been told to me, I wasn't in Ruby at the time, but it was the largest boat that ever came up the Yukon River. And it burnt so much wood that it burned up all the wood on the Yukon River and it only made one trip, didn't it? A couple of trips. It didn't make too many trips.
It carried a scow just to carry wood for itself.
Yeah.
Seven
stars, yeah, it was an awful big boat.
I have the record from 1905 to 1909.
Yeah.
Five trips to town on the relay,
too. It was too big for the upper. Break up there a little bit. It could take 5 bars. Yeah.
It was
one of the
better things.
I don't remember that boat, but I remember being told about it. Yeah, the Isom, yeah. Yeah, but that wasn't in what you'd call really early days. That was in 1928. I raced from here to Chattanooga and back. Yeah. That was in one day. That was the same year, yeah. Yeah. Dave brought back a load of wood. Dave brought back a load of wood. I think he had four or five or six dogs, and well, he went into it just for the fun of it anyway. He didn't go around the course anyhow. He just went out and got a load of wood and came back to town. But at that time, I think there was only three colored people in the town. Dave Stanford was a colored man, and there was Ben Green, and one other colored man. Yeah, three, I think.
George Preston.
Yeah, Preston, yeah. But he only three colored men in Fairbanks. Yeah.
Hey, Tom, how many children went to school this week?
Well, children will be were mixed at that time. They were native and white, although predominantly white in those days, but now more so native. But I'd say, that'd be between 40, 45, somewhere around there.
How many teachers you have?
Well, we had one, sometimes we had two. We had new teachers every year. Couldn't stand the outfit more than a year, but to back outside again and get married. Alaska was a paradise for teachers to get married in those days. They only lasted a year, but they were either married or gone back to the States. I walked up over the trail. It was 9 days from the time I left Ruby to the time I arrived in Indiana, and I stayed 1 day in Tanana, rested 1 day, didn't travel at all. I traveled, it was about an average of 30 miles a day, but they had roadhouses every 14, and another roadhouse to make that in the evening to stop at, or 20 miles at the farthest between the roadhouses. At that time, well, 1928, I was 20. I was born in age. I was 20 years old. I was 19, actually, because I hadn't reached.
You walked alone?
I walked alone, yeah. But the trail was good. See, I walked to Tanana, and Shade, what was Shade's first name?
Charlie
Shade. You see, from Nenana to Tanana, the mail was hauled by horses. And the trail goes all inland, all the way to Tanana, because the Tanana River is unsafe to travel on. So they never used it for travel much. I don't mean unsafe that no one traveled on it, but they didn't want to travel on it with the horses and the mail. It stayed inland all the time, parallel to the river. And they used double engines. One horse would pull one, and the other horse would come behind with another sled, you know, little sleds. You know, each horse had a sled pulling one behind the other. And Charlie Shade was in Tanana at the time that I got into Tanana, and I thought that I might be able to get a ride off and on with him with the horses between Tanana and Nenana. But he was, besides hauling the mail, he was hauling food, so he had to walk himself. I just kept on walking, and I made better time than he did between the roadhouses, because he'd stop and rest the horses.
How was the weather?
Well, no, it was good. It was in February, and the trail was good in those days. There was lots of travel, so the trail was hard. I walked right on foot. No snowshoes or anything. Just as hard as this floor. Yeah, the tower house in Tanana, yeah. And Anderson was running the Fish Lake Roadhouse. Yeah. It was about 240 miles. Yeah, I took census the winter of 1939-40. I had my own dog team, and I received $25 a day for the dog team, $6 a day wages, and $6 a day for dying, so that was $37 a day for the team and myself. And I had, in towns and Tanana and Manly Hot Springs and different places, I wouldn't enumerate the people in the town. They were taken care of by the school teachers or the commissioner in the town. The only ones that I enumerated were trappers and prospectors. and I traveled in 2 months' time, 60 days, a distance of 1,200 miles, and enumerated 200 people. I traveled 5 days for one man. Cost the government $185 for that man. I didn't miss any because it was more to my advantage to go after him. That's why I traveled 5 days for that one man. The winter of 1939-40. That was the last time I think it was taken all by dog team down there. And I went out there and I covered the creek out in back of Ruby. And I came on up the Yukon River and I went up the Novi. That's a tributary to the Yukon River. It comes in about 40 miles above Ruby. Then I came on up the Yukon River and went over to Morlock Creek. You know where that is, I guess. Went over there. There was one man there. That was a 2 day trip, one day over and one day back. And Redlands, Tom Charland, yeah, he was the one I went over to the Redlands, that's across from Canada. He was one man, Tom Charland, he was up in there, he was trapping. And I was 3 days going in to where he was and 2 days coming back out on my own trail. But I had the snowshoe in ahead of the dogs. I had a tent, a stove, I hauled my own dog feed, I hauled my own food. At night, I'd muck out the snow down to the ground and down to the moss, put up a tent, Yukon stove, bed down the dogs, and then I had to cook for the dogs besides because there wasn't enough fish at that time, so I had to use rice and cornmeal as an additive to just dip the fish in it to give it a fish flavor. There wasn't any fish to be had. Yeah. Well, that's about all I can say, Harry, that I know.
Do you remember any odd experiences you told me several stories, and I don't want to
coach
you.
No. I don't know. Well, I can tell one story. I stopped in a roadhouse once, and it was a native roadhouse run by natives. And stew was cooking, big pot of steam, had a big long spoon in it, you know, one of these big long spoons. And I had food in the sled of my own, but I was going to stay there that night. And stirred the stew up. Up come a rabbit's head with the eyes still in it, and so that was enough for me. I had my own food.
Was it ever cold? I had any narrow experience.
Yes, I did, right in that dog race in 1928. I drove 11 dogs in that race. I drove Broflat's dogs. He was a dentist here. He had 21 Siberian dogs, and I'd driven lots of dogs, had been raised with dogs, and so he asked me, I was going to high school here, if I'd train and drive his team, and I said I would, and I was going to school, and I used to train the dogs, I'd go to school, it'd be dark like this when I'd get out in the wintertime, and I'd hitch up 11 dogs, and I'd drive out South Crested here, and out over in towards the Wood River country. And I'd run them maybe 30, 35 miles after school. And bring them in and hitch them. And I'd be in the dark. I'd hitch up in the dark and go out in the dark and come back in the dark during the dark days of the winter. Well, I reduced the dogs from 21 down to 11 that I was going to use. And 2 days before the race, well, a week before the race, I went around the course, and then 2 days before the race, I went around the course after Chattanooga and back. And the course at that time went from here to Fox, and from Fox to Olmos, up over Scrapford Hill. You had to climb up over Scrapford, drop down into Dome, down into Olmos. Then you followed the old railroad track from Olmos, the ties and the little trestles and everything. into Chattanooga, and then you came back by the government road. But the government road wasn't plowed out at that time because it wasn't used. It was drifted, all drifted full, like your slope on the other side would be, you know, sloped off, drifted very slightly, and so would it be on this side. And it was 30 below the day of that race. Well, I didn't have to make the story right way. I told Grofflet, the 11 dogs that I drove, I tried them out before the race, and I said I only wanted to take 9, because I figured the 2 wouldn't make the course. So, he was still wanting me to drive 11. He'd sent to Nome for one piece section of tow line. It was all made of walrus. Most tow lines are made in sections, two dog sections. You've got a ring, and then you've got a snap and another section of tow line, so you can increase your team or decrease your team, whatever you want to do, by taking out a section of tow line. But this section of tow line is all made in one piece, made out of a walrus side, so he wanted me to use that. So I said, okay, so I used it in the 11 dogs. Well, the first dog collapsed about 2 miles this side of Chattanooga, and I had that one in the sled. And it was one of the particular dogs that I didn't want to take. Then about halfway between Chattanooga and Clary, where the other one collapsed. So I had 2 on the sled to claim that Clary Railway. Well, at Chattanooga, I was 2nd. Walter Miller, he raced here at that time, but he was first at Chattanooga. He held first place. He was 2 minutes ahead of me. In the meantime, we drove with a whip in those days. A black snake. He used a black snake, and he had a silk popper on it about that long, braided silk. You'd make the poppers yourself. And I'd make my own tow line, splice my own tow line and all that. But this silk popper, he'd braided out popper, and he'd crack the whip out and crack it. It'd make a loud pop, or you could crack out and nip the dog with if you wanted to. Well, the dogs, training the dogs for racing, well, you train them for business. That is, I mean, it's from the time you let go of the snubbing line, that's the line that you tie the sled with when you're hitching up the dogs. Well, those dogs are ready to go, and they're going all the time, no stop, no stop for nothing. That's the way you train them, to keep going. Ordinary dogs, they don't. They stop when they feel like it. I mean, sled dogs. And in order to get these two dogs out of the team, I had to tip over my sled, bury the bull in the side of the trail to try to hold him, and then work myself up towards the team in order to get the dog out. Well, every time I'd get up to just about where the dog was, and then the team would start. And I'd have to grab the sled as it would go by because the dog figured I was coming up there to work him over a little bit. And I lost my gloves, my heavy gloves, and all I had on was a little pair of jersey gloves, thin gloves. And I had no hat. I lost my hat. And when I got into Fairbanks here, well, I'd froze my fingers back to the 2nd joint, all of them. And I'd froze them so bad that I lost the skin and the flesh and all the nails. They just turned black, just like as if you'd burned them. And freezing, too, as if like a burning anyway. That is when it's thawing out, where you think that you just put your hand on a hot stove. That's the sensation you have from it. And the doctor here at that time was Romig. That's Dr. Romig's in Anchorage. His father was the doctor here at that time. And he said that if I'd have been out a half an hour longer, I'd have lost the fingers. But I didn't lose them.
How did you tell him that?
Well, they thought that, I don't know, according to the old belief at that time, they thawed out the wrong way. But now they've got a new belief about thawing out frost. It used to be that you'd thaw them out in cold, something cold, like cold water, kerosene, or anything but heat. Not to thaw him fast. But now doctors claim that he's thawed in hot water. Causing heavy pain, but I mean, that's the way they do it now. Oh, I don't know. I remember what I was to Chattanooga. I was 2 hours and 32 minutes to Chattanooga. But I was about 3 hours and a half coming back, a little better than 6 hours. I was fourth, just out of the money.
Would you get the rest of it in time?
No money, yeah.
Over?
Well, I've got a couple of 3 minutes for you. Maybe.
Well, that's all I have to say. That's about as much as I can tell.
Okay. Is there anyone else I could ask you any other questions?
No, very good. The speaker was Tom Long, and he was telling about his early days in Ruby and racing around Fairbanks. This is the Alaska Historical Society meeting, and what's the date today? April 26, 1962, Historical Society meeting. This concludes the tape.